How Do People Come to Believe They Were Abducted by Aliens? By Susan A. Clancy. I once had this terrible nightmare. At least I think it was a nightmare. Something was on top of me. It wasn't human. It was pushing into me. I couldn't move. I couldn't scream. I was being suffocated. It was the worst dream I've ever had. When I told my therapist about it, she basically asked me if anything had happened to me as a kid. She was getting at sexual stuff, like if I had been abused. It took me off guard, because I'd never thought about that before. Anyway, she says that sometimes memories that are really traumatic get pushed down by the psyche. It's like a protective mechanism, and that they can kind of pop up in dreams. I don't think I was ever abused. Actually, sex is an area of my life that I pretty much feel in control of. But she made me think, had something happened to me? Maybe something did happen. I wondered a lot because it seemed like my life wasn't going the way it should. Relationships were really hard for me. Getting through graduate school seemed tougher for me than for other people. I have a lot of trouble sleeping. It's so weird because I was such a happy kid. It was around the time I hit puberty that everything changed. For some reason, I started to have images of aliens popping into my head. Did you see that movie Signs? The one with Mel Gibson? The aliens looked more like those, not like the more typical ones. I'd be walking to school and then pop, an alien would be in my head. Sometimes I'd hit my fist against a wall because then the pain would help me think of something else. I really thought I was going crazy. After a while, I told a friend, Rob. I think you spoke with him. He's a graduate student at the Divinity School. He gave me a book to read. The book was called Abduction or Abductions, and it was written by a famous psychiatrist at Harvard. It has lots of stories about people who had been abducted. I read the book in one sitting. I couldn't put it down. It all clicked with me. I knew what the people were going to say even before they said it. I completely got what they felt, the feelings of terror and helplessness. I couldn't stop thinking about the book. Once I started thinking maybe I'd been abducted, I couldn't stop. Finally, I told my therapist about what was going on, and she said she couldn't help me with this. But she referred me to a psychologist in Somerville, someone who worked with people who believe in things like this. The first time I went to see him, he asked me why I was there. I opened my mouth to talk, but I started crying and couldn't stop. The tears were just pouring out of me. I'm not the kind of person who cries easily. I don't think I'm an emotional person. It was then that I understood that there was something going on, that something had happened to me and I didn't know what it was. He said that I shouldn't be afraid, that this was very common, that it was the first stage of coming to realize what happened to me, that in some people, the memories get only partially erased, and that those people can access them if they're willing to do the work, to undergo hypnosis and allow themselves to find out. When I was first recruiting subjects for my study of alien abductees, I assumed that people wouldn't answer my ad unless they had actual memories of being abducted. I mean, the ad read, "Have you been abducted by aliens?" Why would you answer it if you didn't have any such memories? On what other basis would you think you've been abducted? But as it turned out, most people who answered the ad merely believed that they'd been abducted. In fact, they had no detailed personal memories of their abduction experience. An initial phone screening would reveal just that. Yes, they thought they'd been abducted by aliens, so we would set up an interview at my office. The first question I'd ask would be, "How old were you when you had your first memory of being abducted by aliens?" "Oh, I don't have any memories," they'd say. I was amazed. "You don't have any memories of the experience? Why not?" Because I was told their memories had been rendered inaccessible. Some said the reason was that the aliens erased my memories, or the beings programmed the experience to be forgotten. A few believed, like some victims of childhood sexual abuse, that what had happened to them was simply too traumatic to be considered available. The experience was too awful for my mind to handle it, so I repressed it. Whatever the mechanism endorsed, the consequence was the same. There were no personal memories of the abduction. But if they didn't have any memories of being abducted by aliens, then why did they believe they'd been abducted in the first place? Everybody I spoke with had one thing in common. They'd begun to wonder if they'd been abducted only after they experienced things they felt were anomalous, weird, abnormal, unusual things. The experience varied from person to person. They ranged from specific events. I wondered why my pajamas were on the floor when I woke up, to symptoms. I've been having so many nosebleeds. I never have nosebleeds, to marks on the body. I wondered where I got this coin-shaped bruise on my back, to more or less fixed personality traits. I feel different from other people, a loner, like I'm always on the outside looking in. Sometimes they included all of the above. Though widely varied, the experiences resulted in the same general question. What could be the cause? In short, it appears that coming to believe you've been abducted by aliens is part of an attribution process. Alien abduction beliefs reflect attempts to explain odd, unusual, and perplexing experiences. This search for causes was well described by Terry, a 37-year-old elementary school teacher. I went to dinner with some friends. We finished late and I was tired, but instead of just driving home, I felt compelled to drive south out of the city. I drove for like an hour down Route 3, and then I turned around and came home. The next morning when I woke up, I turned on the news and found out that an unidentified flying object had been spotted south of the city in the general vicinity of where I'd been driving. John, a 39-year-old teacher, told this story. I'd lived in the city my whole life, but moved to a very rural area in New York State for a new job. I started to be afraid of being alone, especially at night. I'd been used to peace and quiet, but not anymore. I got, like, really scared to be by myself. I wondered why. Here's Martha, a 27-year-old preschool teacher. About a month ago, I started noticing this bruise on my thighs. I don't know what could be causing it. Every time I think it's going away, it gets dark again. It's really weird. Not like a big deal or anything, but I want to know what it is. And these are the words of a 63-year-old retiree named Renee. Let me tell you, you're a shrink. I've been in therapy basically my whole life, and nothing is helping me. I've tried psychoanalysis, medication, meditation, and I still feel depressed. I've been depressed since as long as I can remember. Something is seriously wrong with me, and I want to know what it is. I want to live a normal life. For many abductees, the I wonder why stage begins after a frightening sleep experience. They wake up suddenly, terrified and paralyzed, sure that something is in the room with them, or that they're hurtling through the air or being electrocuted. Shauna, a 28-year-old bartender and graduate student, told me, one night, I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't move. I was filled with terror and thought there was an intruder in the house. I wanted to scream, but I couldn't get any sound to come out. The whole thing lasted only an instant, but that was enough for me to be afraid to go back to sleep. Mike, a 44-year-old computer programmer, said, I woke up around 3 a.m. and couldn't move. I managed to open my eyes, and there were creatures in the room with me. I saw shadowy figures around the bed. Then I felt this pressure like pain in my genitals. I must have fallen asleep again, because the next thing I remember, it was morning. I woke up in a state of shock. And this is how James, a 50-year-old dermatologist, described it. I found myself waking up in the middle of the night, seized with fear. There were beings standing around my bed, but I was totally paralyzed, incapable of moving. I felt surges of electricity shooting through my body. Scientists have an explanation for these experiences. It's called sleep paralysis, a condition that occurs when our sleep cycle becomes temporarily desynchronized. Instead of moving seamlessly between sleeping and being awake, we find ourselves in a limbo where the two states briefly overlap. When we sleep, certain neural mechanisms block motor output from the brain to the rest of the body so that we're essentially paralyzed. This is important because otherwise we'd be thrashing around, talking, shouting, and lashing out violently in our dreams. But when sleep cycles overlap, it's possible to wake up before sleep paralysis has waned. If this happens, we'll be unable to move. And if we wake up while we're in the process of dreaming, dream material might linger into our waking state. We can find ourselves hallucinating sights, sounds, and bodily sensations. They may seem real, but they're actually the product of our dreams. Despite the bizarre symptoms and effects, sleep paralysis is considered normal, not pathological. About 20% of the population has had at least one episode of this type, accompanied by hallucinations. We are particularly prone to such experiences during periods in which our normal sleep patterns get disrupted. People at risk include night shift workers, travelers with jet lag, parents with newborns, and academics trying to finish grant applications. Though it takes only about half a minute for things to return to normal, for the perceptual, cognitive, and motor aspects of the sleep cycles to become resynchronized, this can seem an awfully long time to the victim. It is a truly frightening experience. That sleep paralysis is normal might be comforting to those affected if they knew what it was. Almost no one does. There are no public policy programs to raise awareness of its existence, no feature articles in major magazines. Doctors don't mention it during checkups, and it's never been the topic of a talk show or popular book. That being said, a lot of people in the world experience sleep paralysis, feel the urge to take long drives at night, are afraid of being alone in rural areas, find weird bruises on their bodies, have unexplained nosebleeds, or feel out of place in society. All of us at some point in our lives have symptoms, feelings, or experiences that we don't understand, but not all of us wonder deeply about them. This might be because we either don't care very much or don't think our experiences have a specific cause. Indeed, some people remain unconcerned in the face of anomalies that would perplex even the most complacent types. Yep, I got this rash all over me. Doc said it's something called purpura, pigmented purpura. Nope, don't know how I got it. Nope, not sure when it's going to go away. Contagious? Don't think so. What is it? Well, I already told you, it's purpura. But this isn't the case with abductees. For them, what happened is meaningful, and they want to know the cause. The search for meaning is the catalyst for alien abduction beliefs, but this quest hardly makes abductees unusual. Thinking about oneself, trying to understand why one has certain disturbing or baffling emotions, is a cultural preoccupation, and finding causes for personal experiences and feelings is a major industry. Open the phone book and look at the list of counselors, therapists, homeopaths, psychologists, and psychiatrists. Walk into a bookstore and check out the section on self-help and psychology. Some people believe that if they understand why they feel the way they do, they'll be able to change things for the better. Others are greatly relieved to learn that their problems are caused not by their moral failings, but by a psychological syndrome or a little-known disease. But when there are so many available explanations, from excess carbohydrates to parental neglect, from insufficient Bikram yoga to too much Prozac, why pick alien abductions? What makes abductees unusual is not the perceived strangeness of their experiences or their desire for explanation, but the specific explanation they choose. Why do some people come to believe that their sleep paralysis experiences, or their nighttime urges to take long drives, or the strange marks on their body are caused by extraterrestrials? The answer is that their symptoms, feelings, and experiences are consistent with what they already know or know about alien abduction. In America today, few people are unaware of what aliens look like and what they supposedly do to the human beings they kidnap. Since the 1960s, we've been hearing wildly publicized stories of alien abductions. According to the standard script presented in books, TV shows, and movies, aliens come in the night. When they approach you, you cannot move. You feel terrified and helpless. You levitate, feel vibrations running through your body, see shadowy figures. It's common knowledge that aliens leave strange marks on your body, such as bruises or scoop marks. That UFOs are seen at night from solitary cars on wooded roads. That when you've had an encounter with extraterrestrials, you're unable to account for a period of time. That afterward, you feel anxious or depressed, different from other people and from your former self. For better or worse, alien abduction is one of our culturally available explanations for weird experiences like sleep paralysis and gaps of lost time. In Chapter 4, we'll look at the historical process by which this happened. How, "I've had an encounter with aliens," went from being a sure sign of insanity to the subject of primetime TV shows. Mork and Mindy, Third Rock from the Sun, Roswell, best-selling books, Communion, Abduction, blockbuster movies, Alien, Predator, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Men in Black, Signs, and allegedly serious documentaries. When you're looking for the cause of an anomalous experience, your search is limited to the set of explanations you've actually heard of. For most of us, the set of possible explanations is far from complete. We're unaware of the prevalence of sleep paralysis, sexual dysfunction, anxiety disorders, perceptual aberrations, chemical imbalances, memory lapses, and psychosomatic pain. But our set of possible explanations does include alien abduction, because everyone knows about aliens and their modus operandi. They come in at night, fill you with terror, kidnap you, and erase your memories. What happened to me is just like what everyone else says happened to them. I'm not really into science fiction stuff. Before this happened, I never believed in aliens. But what I saw on that TV show is exactly like what happened to me. Look at things from the perspective of 40-year-old Mike, who's had a frightening episode of sleep paralysis. He thought he was going to die. He's never had an easy time sleeping, and now he's absolutely terrified. He has to know what happened to him. Some possible explanation occurred to him. He's going crazy. He eats too much before going to bed. There are robbers in the house. He has brain cancer. He saw something supernatural, like ghosts or aliens. He's not sure. Okay, the supernatural explanations are unlikely, but the other ones just don't seem quite right. They don't fit what happened. It was unlike anything that ever happened to me. Days later, browsing through the remainders in a local bookstore, he sees a book entitled Communion by Whitley Strieber. He leafs through it and discovers, on page 27, that the author once had a sleep experience just like his. And just like him, Strieber was freaked out and was afraid to go back to sleep. And just like him, Strieber always had a tough time sleeping and relating to women and figuring out what he wanted to do with his life. And it's a published book, a bestseller, nonfiction. Mike buys it and keeps reading, and then, in a later chapter, he finds out that Strieber was prone to headaches and nightmares as a kid, just like him. All these coincidences are too much. Did what happened to Strieber happen to him? Could he have been abducted by aliens? Another one of my abductees, 27-year-old Larry, had a weird dream in which he saw shadowy figures standing around his bed. He woke up with a stabbing pain in his genital area. It was a terrifying experience. Familiar with Close Encounters of the Third Kind and other movies about aliens, he wondered if he might have encountered extraterrestrials. Upon reflection, however, the shadowy figures seemed to him too tall. I don't think aliens are that tall. Next, he considered the possibility that the groin pain stemmed from a repressed memory of childhood sexual abuse. He began to review family photo albums in an effort to retrieve memories of what might have happened to him. Because of the groin pain, the feelings that he was somehow special, different from other people, and the stealthy nature of the experience, he briefly wondered whether a high-tech bio firm in the area had sent employees into his home to take some sperm samples, but he quickly dismissed this as being too unlikely. He considered the possibility that the experiences were spiritual in nature, but I doubt that angels would wear hoods. He tentatively settled on the childhood sexual abuse explanation. Only after undergoing therapy and failing to recover memories of childhood sexual abuse did Larry conclude that he had been abducted by aliens. Someone else I interviewed, a man named Paul, 41, was working for a resort in the Caribbean when he had two strange experiences. In one, he woke up naked on the couch, but he couldn't remember either lying down there or undressing. In the other, he dreamed he saw a small creature by his bed wearing a silver tracksuit, and he told the creature, "I hate what you're doing to me." After these experiences, he started to feel vulnerable when he went to bed. He stopped sleeping naked. He described himself as a new agey guy who believed that Western science is very limited in its understanding of the universe. I'm open to things other people might not accept as being real. He had read widely about past lives, ESP, spirits, and extraterrestrials. He also told me that he was very interested in earth spirits that feature in native folktales. He considered each possible cause, but the only explanation that seemed to fit was aliens. "I hear that they come into your bedroom and take you, and when they put you back, it's in a different place." According to John, the teacher mentioned above, trouble sleeping could have a lot of causes. Could be stress. Could be that I'm not used to the new place yet. Could be something worse, like being contacted by aliens. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but who knows? This world is a weird place. There's a lot we don't know. I've been stressed before, but I haven't had trouble sleeping. So people choose alien abduction as an explanation because they can. In the words of retiree Doris, 73, from New Hampshire, "Why else would I wake up flying over my bed?" "But it's so unreasonable," one hardcore skeptic said to me. "There's no evidence that aliens even exist, never mind that they actually come to our bedrooms at night." While this is true, it's not clear that the average person knows just how little evidence exists for extraterrestrial life, or just how improbable visits from extraterrestrials are. For most people, reports by other individuals count as evidence, especially if those others appear sane, attractive, and respectable. Betty and Barney Hill, the mom and pop of abductees, became famous in abduction history in the 1960s because, in the words of Seth Shostak, an astronomer associated with the SETI Institute, they were more or less Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch. A number of equally sane, attractive, and respected people have since produced best-selling books and popular screenplays about their abduction experiences, and many people view this large body of testimony as powerful evidence. But because the scientific community disagrees, abductees gripe that scientists don't pay attention to our experiences. For a scientist, anecdotes don't count as evidence. 1,000 individual eyewitness reports are no more meaningful than one. This is because humans are fallible, And even with the best of intentions, we have limited knowledge and we all make mistakes. What we think we saw may not be what we saw at all. So from a scientific perspective, the only good way to validate a claim is to do so objectively. How do we know the Earth is round? Because the Earth's shadow on the moon is round. Because photographs from outer space show that the Earth is round. Because a ship's top mast is the last thing you see as the ship sails off toward the horizon. We don't know the Earth is round because your boss's cousin, who's a very respectable guy, said so. If anecdotal evidence or the words of attractive authorities could be relied on, we'd have to accept that Yeti and the Loch Ness Monster exist, that Elvis Presley, James Dean, and Jimi Hendrix are alive, that psychoanalysis cures schizophrenia, and that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq at the time of the 2003 invasion. It's interesting that people seem to find anecdotal evidence compelling when the issue is alien abductions, but not when the issue is, say, murder. Perhaps this is because there have been so many recent TV crime shows, such as CSI, Crime Scene Investigation Las Vegas, and its offspring, CSI Miami and CSI New York, that clearly demonstrate what types of evidence are required to convict a suspect. In these shows, people get convicted on the basis of sperm samples, blood spray patterns, body temperatures, and the type of bug crawling in the victim's nasal cavities. Not because of what Bob told my cousin Helen, and she never lies. The possibility that aliens exist and that they visit the Earth doesn't seem all that implausible to many people. In fact, it seems quite probable. According to recent polls conducted in the United States, about 94% of respondents said they thought that intelligent aliens exist. In a more recent poll conducted by CNN, 65% of respondents thought that UFOs had actually visited Earth. In the words of 83-year-old Joe, a retired construction worker, "I think ETs must exist. There are so many planets. No reason to think it's just us out there. Hell knows there's nothing special about us. Scientists don't know everything. No one can prove they don't exist. And it would make sense that something else is out there. Some kind of god or something above us. I like the idea that there's something magical out there. I have this buddy, and when he's had a few beers, he talks about what happened to him. He was driving to Vegas one night and he saw something, a light in the sky. It followed him. He blacked out. And when he woke up, the car was in a ditch. He had no memory of what happened. Like I said, he don't talk about it much. But when he does, he thinks something happened to him. He thinks something's going on. Why else would all these people be talking about it? Why all the movies and books and all that? Where there's smoke, there's fire, I always said. And all those books written by military people? I'm not saying anything for sure. I'm just saying there's a lot going on out there that people don't know about. What do we think? That we're alone out there? Then where do we come from? The Big Bang they talk about. Well, what about before that? And everyone gets worked up about how they're taking people in secret through walls. Why do we think that ETs, if they exist, would have the same laws of gravity or biology or whatever? Maybe another kind of being or life exists, one we can't even imagine. Anyway, all I'm saying is that anything is possible, and that there must be something going on for all these people to be saying the same thing. Attention, the wife says. They're doing it to get attention. But who would want to have that happen to them? Many people would agree with some or all of what Joe says, but there are a lot of problems with it. For one thing, the sheer number of planets argument overlooks the fact that no matter how many planets there may be, they have to be hospitable to life. And, as we know, just looking around at our own solar system, the right environment is not easy to come by. Is a certain planet just the right distance from its sun? Does it have the right temperature? Is there any water? Is it dense enough to support an atmosphere? If we consider all the prerequisites for life, this drastically reduces the number of planets available. But let's say that some other type of life does exist somewhere in the universe. What are the odds that it evolved far enough to be intelligent? Evolution is opportunistic and unpredictable, and there's no inexorable path from one-celled organism to intelligent, self-aware life. In fact, 99 out of every 100 newly arising species become extinct. Earth is a planet hospitable to life, and life did arise here. Since then, more than 1 billion species of animals have come into existence, yet only one possesses a conscious intelligence. Humans are a miracle. But let's say, for the sake of argument, that self-aware, intelligent life did exist elsewhere in the universe. Why would those beings develop the fantastic technology they would need to get here across interstellar distances? Moreover, why would they want to? Why would such superior beings be interested specifically in us? Why would they be interested in egg harvesting and sperm sampling? Why would they be taking the same bits and pieces of people over and over again? The whole idea of aliens coming to Earth in UFOs and kidnapping humans for medical and genetic experimentation is not only extremely unlikely, it's downright silly. Especially the part where the aliens wait nervously while you're getting undressed. But, like many of us, believers don't think in terms of probability and don't habitually look for the simplest explanation. I always ask the abductees I met, "Do you think there's a better explanation for what happened to you?" And in essence, they always answered, "Maybe, but I trust my gut and my gut says aliens." Even if people did know how to think probabilistically and parsimoniously, would they? Even if they understood that anecdotal reports don't count as evidence, that the probability of alien life is infinitesimally low, never mind alien life that defies all known laws of physics, biology, and chemistry to abduct you from your bedroom and mate with you, would they think any differently? I doubt it. Lots of crash courses in scientific thinking might whittle down the number of people who believe, but believers would still exist. When people are sorting through possible explanations for their anomalous symptoms and experiences, especially emotionally powerful ones, they rely not on abstract principles of parsimony or probability, but on what seems to fit, or feels right, or makes emotional sense. Schizophrenia researchers know this. For almost a century, they've been trying to understand how patients form delusions. In psychopathology, the term delusion refers to a false belief that is strongly held despite outside evidence and that is entirely resistant to disconfirmation. Delusions are, along with hallucinations, one of the hallmarks of psychosis, colloquially referred to as being crazy. That being said, there is a good deal of disagreement in the field about what precisely constitutes the difference between a delusion, "I am the new Messiah," and a strongly held idea, "I have been abducted by aliens." Brendan Mayer, one of my teachers, used to say that if the hair stands up on your arm while a person describes what he believes, then you're probably dealing with a psychotic. Textbooks suggest that one can distinguish delusions from non-pathological beliefs according to the degree of conviction with which individuals hold to their beliefs, despite clear contradictory evidence. One noted researcher on hypochondriasis taught that the distinction could be made on the basis of whether the individual is willing to entertain the notion that he might be wrong about his belief. Today, delusions are generally understood as patients' best explanations for the odd sensory and perceptual experiences that are part and parcel of their disorders. According to this perspective, delusions reflect not disordered thinking, but normal thought processes that people engage in to explain their perceived abnormal experiences. That is, why they feel the way they do. Brendan Mayer offered a memorable example in his Psychopathology of Delusion course at Harvard. He described the case of a woman who believed she had a hive of bees buzzing and stinging in her head. She complained about the bees for years. After she died, an autopsy revealed a brain tumor. It was the tumor which had almost certainly caused the weird sensation of buzzing and stinging that she'd felt and, quite naturally, tried to explain. Though I was impressed by this theory of delusions, that they were people's explanations for their anomalous experiences, one thing bothered me. Why did the explanations have to be so weird? Why did the woman in Mayer's explanation speak of a beehive and not side effects from a neurological condition that is impairing my sensory and perceptual symptoms? Why would someone say, "The CIA is after me," rather than, "I'm losing my hearing"? I remember Brendan Mayer looking at me across the room, smiling patiently and saying, "Because that's what it felt like to them." For a long time, I didn't really understand what he was talking about. But today, thanks to the alien abductees, I do. Though I'm far from suggesting that alien abductees tend to be psychotic or otherwise psychiatrically impaired, they do hold false beliefs, ones that appear to be natural byproducts of their attempts to explain the unusual things that have happened to them. So in that sense, research on the psychopathology of delusions extends nicely to non-pathological beliefs like alien abductions. It baffled me that most of my abduction subjects had considered and rejected alternative explanations, ones that were more reasonable and more probable than an explanation based on aliens. Why choose the outlandish explanation? Given all the available explanations for sleep problems, depression, and sexual dysfunction, why choose the weird and disturbing one? The one that was likely to stigmatize them and cost them their friends? My interviewees answered this question for me and confirmed what Brendan Mayer told me 10 years ago. Robin, a lovely and intelligent 21-year-old college student, said it best. "I know you think it sounds weird. Everyone does. I do too. But what you don't understand is that I know the abduction was real, so it doesn't matter what you think. What I felt that night was overwhelming, terrifying. There was something in the room with me. All I can say is that it happened to me. It didn't happen to you. I felt them. Aliens." What emerges again and again from the subject's statements is that what happened to them felt alien. It didn't feel as if it could be explained in conventional, ordinary, mundane ways. As Mayer and others have argued, delusions, false beliefs, are people's best attempts to explain their anomalous experiences. And the vividness and immediacy of personal experience cannot be easily refuted. Assuring abductees that what they believe happened is infinitely unlikely, that there is no evidence to support it, is a waste of time. They have a different, more compelling kind of evidence. First-hand experiences are real. Any experience is accompanied by and dependent upon neural activity. Although neural activity is normally the consequence of external input, it can be created by direct activation of the neural substrate itself. Regardless of the source, instances of neural activity can all feel the same. Hence, the only way to distinguish between a feeling that an abduction occurred and its objective reality is through objective corroboration, something that in the case of alien abduction just doesn't exist. So what are the kinds of things that feel so weird to abductees? Let me try to make this argument less abstract. As already described, sleep paralysis is an internally generated experience that is often attributed to something external. Aliens. This is because it feels really creepy. Imagine this happening to you. After watching the evening news, you wash your face, brush your teeth, and go to bed. In the middle of the night, you suddenly wake up. You're wide awake. You open your eyes and try to get up, but you can't. You're on your back, completely paralyzed. There is a sinister presence in the room. Then you hear something. Footsteps. Something is padding softly through the room. Your heart is pounding and you try to scream, but you can't. Whatever is in the room moves closer. Then it's on top of you, crushing your chest. You glance to the left and see small, shadowy forms in the corner. Your muscles are clenched and you're aware of electric sensations shooting through your body. Then the sensation stops. The experience passes and you can move again. Your heart rate slowly subsides and you begin breathing normally. What the hell just happened? This is what most people who've had such an experience want to know. It's definitely what I wanted to know the first time it happened to me, and I had just written a paper on the topic. Although the phrase non-pathological desynchrony in sleep cycles kept running through my head the whole time, this certainly didn't alleviate that disorientation or the terror or the gasping for breath. The physicality of it was overwhelming. It was an episode of sleep paralysis, an experience that's been scaring the living daylights out of people for centuries. And for centuries, normal people have been looking for an explanation outside themselves. A sensed presence, a shadowy creature moving about the room, a strange immobility, a crushing pressure, and a painful sensation in various parts of the body have been historically compatible with a host of improbable explanations. The phenomenology of the experience may be the same, but explanations differ depending on what the individuals and the larger culture they live in believe, expect, or infer could be possible. At other times and other places in the world, such night terrors have been interpreted as Satan, demons, witches, dragons, vampires, large dogs, and angels, and erect Gordon. Today, it's extraterrestrials. Yet, although it's true that, phenomenologically speaking, sleep paralysis and alien abduction experiences have a lot in common, there is one important difference. Sleep paralysis is a fact. Alien abduction isn't. So if you wake up in the middle of the night levitating above your bed and spinning like a chicken on a rotisserie, you should understand that the experience is roughly a billion times more likely to have been caused by something normal than by something paranormal. But be careful about telling this to an actual abductee. Susan. You know, it's interesting. The experience of sleep paralysis and contact with aliens have a lot in common. But the thing is that sleep paralysis is a well-documented medical experience. And so far as we know, there's no evidence that aliens exist. Don't you think that your experience is much more likely to have been caused by sleep paralysis? Abductee. No. Cell phone conversation overheard through the door a few minutes later. I'm totally pissed. Can you believe the nerve of that girl? She comes to me like, oh, I believe you've been abducted. Let me interview you to learn more about the phenomenon. And then she brings up this sleep paralysis. Oh, what really happened to sleep paralysis? Right. Did she have it happen to her? I swear to God, if someone brings up sleep paralysis to me one more time, I'm going to puke. There was something in the room that night. I was spinning. I blacked out. Something happened, and it was terrifying. It was nothing normal. Do you understand? I wasn't sleeping. I was taken. I was violated, ripped apart. Literally, figuratively, metaphorically, whatever you want to call it. Does she know what that's like? I'm out of here. You can't disprove alien abductions. All you can do is argue that they're improbable and that the evidence adduced by the believer is insufficient to justify the belief. Ultimately, then, the existence of ETs is a matter of opinion, and the believers have their own opinions based on firsthand experiences. They are the ones who had the experiences that require explanation. They are the ones who can't tell us which explanation seems to fit best. All of the subjects I interviewed followed the same trajectory. Once they started to suspect they'd been abducted by aliens, there was no going back. I have no idea what the turning point might be for those who start to believe and then are convinced otherwise. This would be an interesting area of research. Perhaps it would shed light on psychological and cognitive factors that are prophylactic against creating false beliefs. Once the seed of belief was planted, once alien abduction was even suspected, The abductees began to search for confirmatory evidence. And once the search had begun, the evidence almost always showed up. The confirmation bias, the tendency to seek or interpret events favorable to existing belief and to ignore or reinterpret unfavorable evidence, is ubiquitous, even among scientists. Once we've adopted the initial premises, "I think I've been abducted by aliens," we find it very difficult to disabuse ourselves of them. They become resilient, immune to external argument. We seem to be habitual deductivists rather than inductivists in our approach to the world. We do not simply gather data and draw conclusions. Instead, we use our prior information and theories to guide our data gathering and interpretation. Once abductees have embraced the abduction theory, everything else tends to fall into place. Alien abduction easily accommodates a great variety of unpleasant symptoms and experiences. It can explain anything and everything. "I always had nightmares as a kid." "Well, I had a troubled adolescence." "I'm not even interested in sex." "I've been having stomach pains." "I keep failing rehab." One subject, who was part alien, finally found an answer to a lifelong question. "I look at my mother and I think to myself, I don't know you. Who are you?" Furthermore, once you believe, your belief becomes unfalsifiable. There is no way to prove that aliens don't exist. All you can do is argue that there's no evidence they do, that their existence is improbable. Abduction beliefs fall into Karl Popper's category of unfalsifiable propositions. They may be scientifically meaningless, but we don't live in a science lab. We live in the real world. In the real world, people don't ask whether there is enough evidence to justify their beliefs. They ask, what are the costs and benefits? Believing in aliens might cost them some friends. Relinquishing their belief would cost them a lot more. They would have to find another explanation and cast aside a compelling theory for their scary and unpleasant symptoms and experiences. Nowadays, when skeptics say to me, "People must be really nuts to think they've been abducted," I disagree. First of all, coming to believe that one has been abducted by aliens doesn't happen overnight. It's a gradual process. It progresses in fits and starts through many stages in which the possibility comes to seem more and more believable. Second, as we shall see in Chapter 3, very few people are dead sure they've been abducted by aliens until they get their memories. After that, well, if you had vivid memories of being sucked up into a tube of light, you'd probably be sure too. Third, all people want to understand why weird and confusing things happen to them. For better or worse, alien abductions have become one of the explanations culturally available to us. Fourth, very few of us are trained to think probabilistically and parsimoniously, and even if we were, we still couldn't refute belief in alien abduction. Finally, abductees generally entertain a number of possible explanations before embracing the theory of alien abduction. The reason they ultimately endorse abduction is actually quite scientific. It is the best fit for their data, their personal experiences. And skeptics can't critique those data because they have no access to them. Abduction beliefs are natural byproducts of our attempts to explain the unusual things that can happen to us. Given that most of us want to understand our feelings, that very few of us think like scientists in our everyday life, and that alien abduction is a culturally available script, I often wonder why more people don't think they've been abducted. Today, confessing to such a belief doesn't make you crazy. It just puts you, in my opinion, a couple of standard deviations from the norm. 10 years from now, believing in aliens and in their presence among us will perhaps become as common as believing in God.